Ja, schönen guten Abend, ich möchte Sie herzlich begrüßen zu unserer heutigen Vorlesung. Ich freue mich sehr, dass Dagmar Herzog gekommen ist und das ist ja auch der Grund, warum wir sozusagen vom Dienstag auf den Montag geswitcht sind und auch noch die Zeit verändert haben. Aber ich hoffe, Sie haben all die Veränderungsbewegungen irgendwie nachvollziehen können. Wir waren gestern selber etwas überrascht, weil Dagmar sagt, ja, wir kommen auch dran, jetzt kann ich sein, eigentlich um 6. Und ja, also schön, dass Sie sozusagen noch ausgeharrt haben, falls Sie die Idee hatten, dass es schon um 6 Uhr losgegangen ist. Ja, ich möchte Dagmar Herzog ganz kurz vorstellen. Vielen von Ihnen ist sie ja schon bekannt. Sie ist US-amerikanische Historikerin, Professorin für Geschichte an der City University in New York. Und wir haben gestern so besprochen, eigentlich gibt es 3 Themen, die jetzt so dein Leben irgendwie durchziehen, nämlich Sexualität, Holocaust und Religion und der Zusammenhang zwischen diesen 3, vielleicht auf den ersten Blick etwas differenten, distinkten Gebieten. Und Dagmar Herzog ist bekannt für originelle Thesen, also überraschende Zusammenhänge. Also eine besteht zum Beispiel darin, dass sie sehr minutiös eben mit den Mitteln einer Historikerin aufzeigt, wie Diskurse über Sexualität gebraucht werden, um Vergangenheitsbewältigung zu betreiben. Und dass der Blick sozusagen auf Vergangenheit, also zum Beispiel wie Holocaust und Nationalsozialismus, sehr stark dann auch nochmal geprägt sind dadurch, wie Sexualität in diesem Kontext beschrieben wird. Darum wird es heute nicht gehen, sondern eine weitere Leidenschaft ist eben auch oder eine besondere Affinität zur Psychoanalyse. Darüber freue ich mich als Analytikerin natürlich sehr, dass du immer einen sehr kritischen Blick auf Psychoanalyse, psychoanalytische Konzepte und ihre Geschichte wirfst. Das wird uns sozusagen heute beschäftigen. Und ja, danach darf ich Sie einladen auf ein Glas Wein oder Wasser und ein paar Brezen. Also wir haben da so einen kleinen Empfang noch vorbereitet, dann können die Diskussion dann noch weitergeführt werden. Vielen Dank, dass du dazu gekommen bist.
Wir freuen uns. A great honor to be here. Und ich kann tatsächlich Deutsch sprechen und es tut mir schrecklich leid, dass ich das jetzt auf Englisch machen werde. But that was the request, that I'll be speaking in English. But if you're having trouble understanding me in English, if your English is like, what is she talking about? Just wave your hand and stop me and I'll try to say it in German, okay? So the reason I'm showing the slides is that you can see many of my primary sources, meine Primärquellen, will be there in the slides. And as Ilka said, I am technically a historian of sexuality and a Holocaust studies scholar. Like, how the hell did I come to this topic of psychoanalysis? I'm an outsider. I have not been on the couch on either side of it. But I'm interested in it, not least because I'm interested in human beings' apparent ambivalences about sexual freedom, because I've done a lot around issues of sexual politics. And I'm interested in the question, very pertinent to our present, also in my country, under Trump, about why human beings are so often drawn to the right wing politically and not to the left. Like, what makes the right so attractive? And actually, this issue of ambivalence about sexual freedom and attraction to right wing politics were two of the reasons that I wanted to study the history of psychoanalysis. So, my paper today is part of a larger intellectual history project called War Freud. It's on the transatlantic politics of psychoanalysis and the impact of history on theory. So it's not about the clinical interactions, it really is about the political implications of psychoanalysis. And what I mean is the impact of really epical historical transformations like the Third Reich and the Holocaust, or decolonization in the Vietnam War, or the sexual revolution and the rise of gay liberation and women's rights. The impact of these huge historical transformations on psychoanalytic theory, especially psychoanalytic theory around the themes of desire, anxiety, aggression, and trauma. As you well know, Freud died in 1939, so it's an oxymoron. It's not possible to have Cold War Freud. This is about post-Freud Freudianism. And the book has 3 parts. And in the first part, I look at the move into political conservatism in the post-war period. So I divide the Cold War into 2 halves, 1949 to 69 and 69 to 89. And 49 to 69 is when psychoanalysis was unbelievably popular in the United States. It's the most powerful golden age of psychoanalysis. And it's also a time when psychoanalysis was intensely politically conservative. And I'll be talking about that first chapter out of that part today, just so you kind of are oriented. In the middle part, I turn to the long-delayed but then very intense grappling with the legacies of Nazism and the Holocaust around themes of trauma and aggression. I can show you pictures of that, right? And I also, in that context, talk about the Latin American Cold War dictatorships and torture and disappearances, and the ways in which theories of trauma were translated then into the context of the Latin American problems, Cold War dictatorships. And then also around theories of aggression is another thing in terms of Mitscherlich and Rowlands and the return of psychoanalysis to post-Nazi Germany. And then in the third part, I talk about Radical Freud. So I talk about the second half of the Cold War, 1969 to 1989, and the two examples I give, this is a second golden age, but it's a radical leftist, subversive, generous interpretation of Freud. And I talk about the leftist Lacanian, Kleinian, Fanonian, Felix Guattari, co-author of the counterculture classic Anti-Oedipus. And then I talk also about, in the final chapter, Fritz Morgenthaler and Paul Parin, and Goldie Parin-Mattheim, a trio of Swiss radical analysts who worked at the border of psychoanalysis and anthropology, and one of whom, Fritz Morgenthaler, the one on the far left there, who became the first European analyst of any nationality since Freud to declare that homosexuality is not a pathology. So the arc of the whole book runs from desire through trauma and aggression and then back to desire. But what I want to talk about today is the very first part. And I just want to consider a few questions together with you. The first question is, what happens to theories when they travel, when they go across the ocean, when a body of ideas that was born in turn of the century Central Europe, Vienna, Budapest, Berlin, comes across the Atlantic to the United States several decades later at a moment of intensified anti-communism? Another question is, what were some of the unexpected long-term effects of the very strong associations made between Jewishness and Freudianism's supposed over-preoccupation with sex by critics of psychoanalysis? So both Nazis and Christians criticized psychoanalysis for being too Jewish and too sex-obsessed. Mm-hmm. And then I'm asking this puzzle of how did this really weird kind of psychoanalysis emerged in the post-war period in the United States. It is at one and the same time titillating, Germans would say schlüpfrig or anzüglich, yeah? And on the other hand, it's oppressively normative, so unterdrückend, wertend, normativ. And how can you have this combination, schlüpfrig and normativ zugleich? That's the puzzle. It's a komische Mischung, yeah? And that's the puzzle I'm trying to explain, of how did that happen? So in no other time and place was Freudian psychoanalysis more successful, and psychiatry, the medical subspecialty, nowhere else was it more psychoanalytically influenced than in the first two Cold War decades in the United States, so 49 to 69. It's the time and place where psychoanalysis gained the greatest traction in medicine and in mainstream culture. But it's also a time when the psychoanalysis that was so successful was intensely conservative. Americans would say misogynist, Frauenfeindlich, yeah, sexistisch, and homophobic. So Frauenfeindlich and homophob, and authoritarian, not just towards patients, though that also, but also towards trainee candidates. And what happened is that two decades in, so 49 to 69, this is the thing I'm talking about, is how it got so sexually conservative when it came to the United States. And two decades in, it collapsed nearly entirely, under the impact of women's rights activism and gay rights activism and the general anti-Vietnam War movement and African-American civil rights and just everybody's defiance, anti-authoritarian defiance. That's precisely the same moment, 1969, this moment of rebellion, when psychoanalysis rises again in Europe, France, Italy, Germany, carried by the New Left, by the women's movement, by the gay rights movement. The gay rights movement in West Germany wanted more psychoanalysis, more Freud, not less. Exactly the opposite is happening in the United States. In the United States, it's totally conservative. First two post-war decades, it gets crushed by these movements. In Europe, on the other side, it's finally rising again, and it's a subversive, radical, generous Freud that is being reclaimed. Okay, but we're going to go back to the U.S. So there's several theories about why the early post-war United States psychoanalysis was politically conservative. Historians have four explanations. One of them has to do with the fact that in the United States, only medical doctors were allowed to become psychoanalysts. Okay? There was no lay analysis. So there was an impact of medicalization that blunted the politics. A second theory is that there was active silencing of the more radical analysts. In other words, an internal cleansing of the profession where basically the psychoanalysts just drove the leftists out. A third one related is that there was pressure from the United States government. There was really a Red Scare, and there was anti-communist red baiting and intimidating surveillance. Can you imagine as an analyst being, you know, surveilled and watched to see what your patients are talking about and what you're talking about? And the foreign accented emigres, many of them have been socialists or social democrats, were especially treated as especially suspect. A related theory recently has been put forward, has to do with the impact of anti-communism in a different way, which is that there were actually former members of the Communist Party USA who engaged in self-censorship. In other words, denied that they had been Communist Party members, but retained their Stalinist personalities. Mm-hmm. And then finally, and this is the argument that's currently growing in popularity, that you'll hear the most in American circles, which is that psychoanalysis itself needs to be understood as a Holocaust survivor. It's really the phrase used. Traumatized and manically intent on fitting into the host society, which had, after all, given essential safe haven to analysts and their family members fleeing the Nazi onslaught. So all these reasons came together, right? The medicalization, the anti-communism, and the idea that they're a Holocaust survivor as a group that causes them to become just conservative and careful. But this last explanation doesn't really even explain what happened, because it overestimates the impact of the approximately 190, it's less than 200, Jewish analyst refugees from Nazism. So it neglects not just the native-born, already in the US Jews, but also the non-Jewish natives, which are going to be a lot of my subject today. And none of these explanations, you'll notice, the anti-communism, the medicalization, or the Holocaust survivor argument, explains the unmistakable sexual conservatism. So I want to put forward several arguments tonight. One of them involves the point that we need to think of the so-called Jewish science, Jüdische Wissenschaft, of psychoanalysis, and with it, the medical subspecialty of psychiatry, as undergoing a process of Christianization. Die Christianisierung der jüdischen Wissenschaft. Okay. And when I say that, I mean that in a very particular way. And this is hard for Germans to understand, but in the immediate post-war years in the United States, there was a distinctive combination emerging of, on the one hand, heightened religiosity. So surveys were done, and more people said, I go to church, or I'm religious, or I believe in God. We have this on our dollar bills in God We Trust that was put there. It's not there from the beginning. It was put there in the post-World War II period. And this is a trend that was fostered by businessmen. It was patriotic, it was anti-communist, and it was encouraged as a thing that you sort of do respectively. Simultaneously, there is a secularization in the sense that religion is getting increasingly psychologized. So the power of positive thinking is an example by a Protestant minister. But it was incredibly popular, and it's this idea that belief in God can help you do better in business and be more successful. So that is, of course, a kind of secularization at the same time. So when I say that the Jewish science is being Christianized, I just want you to understand that it's a very particular kind of patriotic and communist America Christianization that's going on. And it's happening at the same time that there's a greater religious pluralism, where Protestants and Catholics and Jews are all being treated increasingly similarly in the sense that there's a culture of going to synagogue or going to church that gehört zum guten Ton as part of being a good American, and there's a greater similarity between the denominations. Point number two, battles over the place of libido, as Americans say, not libido, I'm going to hope that you'll forgive me for continuing to say libido, battles over the place of libido within psychoanalysis were crucial for understanding how both psychoanalysis and post-war American psychiatry, the medical subspecialty, evolved as they did. And I mean that both in the sense that the status of libido, like the sex drive, does it matter? Like, is it important in people's lives? And the issue of what does libido mean? Is it like a life force more generally, or is it sexually specific? Both of those things were being debated very strongly. And my third point is that the content of psychoanalysis in the post-war United States was forged in rivalries, in a sequence of competitions, three competitions in particular. One of them has to do with the so-called neo-Freudians, die Neo-Freudianer, like Franz Alexander, Harry Stack Sullivan, Erich Fromm, and above all, from the point of view of her adversaries, infuriatingly feminist and enragingly popular, Karen Horney. She's the most important figure in the Neo-Freudians. Then there's a second competition, and that's with religious leaders, especially the Roman Catholics. And the third one, just when those two challenges were managed, when they'd just gotten the Neo-Freudians out of the way and they'd finally gotten the Roman Catholic Church to shut up, then they seem to manage that. Then comes the sex researcher, Alfred Kinsey. So that's the arc of the story. So they're constantly battling some opposition. And at the heart of all three of these rivalries, Neos, Catholics, and then Kinsey, there's an ambivalence about the centering of libido within the Freudian edifice. And of course, that's perceptive. The ambivalence is total klug, in the sense that humans do, after all, have other motivations besides sexual ones, right? There's aggression, there's anxiety, there's ambition. So on the one hand, it makes complete sense that there would be ambivalence about the centering of sex. And on the other hand, it's problematic. And certainly, the discomfort with libido centrality was exacerbated by the aggressive Nazi rhetoric of the 1930s, in which Freud was said to have a dirty fantasy, eine schmutzige Fantasie, yeah, and psychoanalysis was deemed to contain nothing original. For to claim otherwise, this is all Nazi talk, would be to, as Gänsefüßchen, yeah, quotation marks, to give too much honor to the unproductivity of the Jewish race, and to be nothing other than the Jewish nation's rape of Western culture. Freud's books were burned, and his ideas were both denigrated and stolen. This is a classic example here. This is from 1933, Die Rolle der Juden in der Medizin, Die Psychoanalyse des Juden Sigmund Freud. And you see here a little cartoon, for the typical ugly anti-Semitic portrait of a Jewish guy with a big schnoz. And there's an Aryan woman who comes to him and says, I have headaches. Then he tells her to lie down, because that's what psychoanalysis tell you to do, lie down on the couch, start to free associate. She does that, Braten, Heilquelle, Löschblatt, Taschentuch, Dolch. Dagger, dagger, now I have it. The thought of dagger shows your sexual wishes. Your headache comes from the fact that you are not sexually satisfied in your marriage. Now I know how to help you. So this is just one example, but there were many, many, many anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, grotesque criticisms in the early Nazi period against psychoanalysis, associating it with dirty Jewishness. Okay? And of course, the emigres are going to remember that, and of course, it's going to make them conscious. Ultimately, I have a fourth argument, and that is that it throws throughout. Because what I find really striking about the debates that I'm going to tell you about is that they brought into view very interesting ideas about how we, by which I mean psychoanalysts and historians and other social scientists, might better theorize the relationship between the sexual and other realms of human existence. What's the relation between sex and everything else in people? So I'll look forward to hearing your thoughts about that. In the US, there was an early phase, 1910s, 20s, of flirtation with Freudianism, very much associated with circles of bohemian experimentation in big cities, like sex radical experimentation. But it was not well diffused in the culture as a whole. I mean, it's like Greenwich Village in New York, and that's about it. The real rise of widespread fascination with psychoanalysis in the general public, among medical doctors, and in the social sciences happened in the 1930s and 1940s. And this momentum was driven largely by this group, which is a mixture of both emigres and native people, both Jewish and Gentile, so Jews and non-Jews, loosely referred to as Neo-Freudian. And here they all are. What makes the Neo-Freudians, I just call them the Neos, distinctive is that they care about culture and environment and social pressures in adult daily life. Like, they don't think that what happened to you when you were three is as important as what happened to you yesterday. Okay? So they're thinking about adult daily life, not just the childhood past. And instead of emphasizing the libido, the open search for pleasure, they tend to stress the problem of anxiety. Their big theme is anxiety and a sense of existential unsafety. They think that people don't seek for pleasure, they seek for safety. That's a big difference. The key figures are Sullivan and Fromm, and Karin Horney, there she is, close to and inspired by both, who combined their insights in her 1937 bestseller, The Neurotic Personality of Our Time, and in her influential follow-up book, New Ways in Psychoanalysis. So these are late 1930s. Horney stated directly that Freud's, quote, one-sided consideration of the pleasure principle implicit in the libido theory is wrong and needs to be replaced by a sociological orientation in which the striving for safety in an overwhelming environment is the preeminent human aim. Ja, also die Suche nach Sicherheit ist wichtiger als die Lustsuche. Horney is typically today interpreted as above all a feminist. If you ask most psychoanalysts in the United States, they'll say, oh yeah, yeah, she's the one who said that there's no such thing as penis envy, really men have womb envy. People sort of dismiss her as not even really a psychoanalyst, and above all, she wasn't a feminist. But I think she needs to be understood as a theorist of sexuality and not just of gender. Understand the distinction? Yeah? Mm-hmm. And more importantly, as someone who re-theorized in really interesting ways the relationships between the sexual and other realms of human existence. So, as she put it in her 1937 book, this is the quote, just as all is not gold that glitters, so also all is not sexuality that looks like it, end of quote. Just because something looks sexual and might even involve sexual activity in the narrowest definition of that term does not mean that its purpose or function is primarily sexual. We all can think of examples in our lives about this. Sexual activity might be seen as serving all kinds of other emotional purposes. Moreover, even when there were sexual difficulties, Horney rethought the direction of the causation. So for her, sexual difficulties were the effect rather than the cause of the neurotic character structure. Yeah, was ist die Quelle und was ist der outcome, and for her it was the reverse. And Erich Fromm also, famously, in his magnum opus of 1941, Escape from Freedom, footnoted invoked Horney, and he argued that Freud had gotten the sequence wrong. Also die Reihenfolge ist falsch, ja? So Freud, quote, mistook the causal relation between the erogenous zones and character traits for the reverse of what they really are. So if people have trouble with sex, it's because they have trouble somewhere else in their lives, right? It's not the reductive notion of Freud in which everything that people are having trouble with is because they really have a sexual problem. They flip it. Karin Horney was broadly popular with the public, and she was hugely well-respected across the social science disciplines. So sociologists and anthropologists loved her and are constantly citing her and says, finally, we think psychoanalysis is interesting and makes sense. And she also had many devoted followers within psychoanalysis. But precisely this breadth of success would prove to be a trigger for her rivals. And already at the time, and I've read all the correspondence from that moment, but also in hindsight, it's impossible to sort out what of the hatred directed at her was motivated by professional envy or by sexism, misogyny, and what by sincere theoretical disagreement. But as of 1941, so 2 years after her big book, New Ways, the push to exclude her from professional prestige nationwide was on. And many male psychoanalysts mobilized against her. And this would not fully subside until her death in 1952, which is really pushed out of the profession, sealing the fate of neo-Freudianism more generally, soon to be superseded by the people I call the egos, the ego psychologists, around the Viennese emigre Heinz Hartmann, who in psychoanalytic circles gives the post-war Hartmann era its name, Hartmann, Kluth, and Lowenstein. And then we have Bibbring and Rappaport are sort of the major figures in ego psychology. Nonetheless, and this is quite striking, when Time magazine, which is like Spiegel or Stern, right, in 1946, so 1 year after the end of the war, listed what it saw as the 6 big league practitioners of psychoanalysis in the United States, Karin Horney was still named as one of them. And Horney was the only woman to make the list. As Time also actually explained to its readers that Horneyans are socially conscious and, quote, they dispute Freud's idea that sex is everything. And the other 5 that are named by Time are Franz Alexander, a man named Gregory Zilberg, who turns out to have been an unbelievable charlatan, but was quite famous at the time. He diagnosed a famous musician's problems as neurosis when really it was a brain tumor, and he had his patients, all the lovers and all the partners, marital partners of everybody else. It was a big mess. Anyway, but him. And Lawrence Kuby, they were fashionable Park Avenue analysts in New York. And then there was William and Carl Menninger of Topeka, Kansas's Menninger Clinic. All five of those men that are on this list together with her are dismissive of her, really vehemently contemptuous. Some of them because they never liked her, like Zilberg, or because they were reacting against their own earlier affirmative interest in her work, and that applied particularly to Carl Menninger. And the latter four of them are going to become the main strategic players in the soon-to-erupt battle over whether you can harmonize psychoanalysis and religion. Indeed, the real public face of psychoanalysis in the post-war years is not any emigre from Central Europe, but rather Carl Menninger of the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas, along with his brother William, who had been Brigadier General, like very high up in the armed forces during World War II, responsible for the entirety of psychiatric services for the U.S. Army during World War II. It's a big job. They're very prestigious people. Here they are. So there's Father Menninger and then the two brothers. That's William Menninger at the top, making the cover of Time. That's Carl Menninger. There he is with Anna Freud. They are the public face for most Americans of what psychoanalysis is, and they are Christians, not Jews. The Menningers have three agendas. They want to expand psychiatry across the U.S. It wasn't that big of a subspecialty. There were just maybe 1,000 or so. They really wanted to pour government money into psychiatry, into mental health services. And they used the argument, all these soldiers are returning from war now, and now we need to put more money into psychiatry. They also, number two, wanted to make psychiatry more psychoanalytic, more Freudian, in the way that they thought of it. And they had a big campaign, a mission, to rebut attacks that were coming from the Catholic Church, that somehow Freud and Christianity were incompatible. Because ultimately, the main reason for the neutralization in post-war America of whatever sex radical potential there might once have been in psychoanalysis was a battle over whether Freud could be reconciled with Christianity. And it's not psychoanalysts who provided the initial spark for that conflict, one that ended up just going through all the American media and also reaching over the ocean to the Vatican. Instead, the story started with a rabbi and a bishop. Here we are. Okay. A Boston-based Reform rabbi named Joshua Locke Liebman wrote a book in 1946, 1 year after the war, entitled Peace of Mind, which argued for the benefits of being analyzed to everyone. It ended up on the New York Times bestseller list for 3 years. Sort of incredible, rising to number one for 58 weeks. The book's aim was to reconcile psychiatry and religion. Because you're noticing I'm using psychiatry, psychiatrie, sort of interchangeably with psychoanalysis, which is very different. But the point is that in post-war America, those were pretty blurred. So by psychiatry, Liebman, characteristically for his era, meant psychoanalysis. And he also blended Sigmund Freud and Karen Horney as though that was totally unproblematic. He himself had been analyzed, and he advocated analysis as the healing method best suited to achieving a lasting cure on the grounds that it got at destructive behavior patterns. By religion, okay, he's a rabbi, right? He means a, quote, mature, also reif, as opposed to childish, as opposed to kindish faith in a benevolent and glorious God, a God who is powerful, but who also, in a kind of social gospel or proto-liberation theology way, requires human cooperation to bring about a better world. So it's a social justice-oriented kind of Judaism. The book made Liebman a household name across the United States. I mean, it was wildly popular. And his recommendations, there he is with his wife and his adopted daughter in Ladies' Home Journal, but he's also in Life and every other kind of magazine. And what's incredible is that the adopted daughter is the survivor of Auschwitz. And so there's acknowledgement of catastrophe, and simultaneously, oh, it's so exciting, she's dating now and going to dances, and isn't that wonderful? And it's this classic post-American optimism, uplifting messaging. The book, the surrounding publicity, made him, in the words of historian Andrew Hines, decades before Elie Wiesel, the first iconic Jew of post-war America. The book also, and instantly, infuriated a competing celebrity clergyman. Was it 100 Years of Rivalité, the first
or the second rivalry?
So this is Fulton Sheen. He's a little bit campy. He's a yeah, you should watch him. You can actually see him on YouTube. Professor at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. Host since 1930 of the nationally broadcast nighttime radio program, The Catholic Hour. He received 4,000 letters a week from across the country from listeners, and soon to become, as of 1951, the auxiliary bishop of the Archdiocese of New York. I mean, he would later be called America's bishop. So he's a wildly popular crossover figure, religious figure, but he's a popular advice giver. In March of 1947, so 2 years after the war, Sheen delivered a sermon at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, in which he took direct aim at, and it was reported the next day in the New York Times, quote, psychoanalysis in general and Freudian psychoanalysis in particular. Sheen made unfavorable comparisons between the couch and the confessional. Bei Stuhl und Couch, ja? Klar, was the contract says, okay. Confession was healing, ja? Der Beichtstuhl, das ist heilend. It restores you to relationship with your Heavenly Father. Psychoanalysis, by contrast, cannot relieve the unresolved sense of guilt of sin from which most people who consult psychoanalysts are suffering. This quote continues, there are no more disintegrated people in the world than the victims of Freudian psychoanalysis. Okay. The situation was substantially aggravated because the most famous person that Sheen had succeeded in converting to Catholicism, the former Vanity Fair editor, successful and legendarily beautiful Broadway playwright and member of the U.S. Congress, Claire Booth Luce, had a month earlier, in February 47, begun publishing a three-part essay about her conversion in the popular women's magazine McCall's. I don't know what that's like, Brigitte oder sowas, yeah? Luce argued that her bad experience with psychoanalysis and its silly and gross obsession with sex was, quote, one of the real reasons I became a Catholic. Okay, so because she had such a bad experience because her analyst was constantly getting her to talk about sex, that's why she went to Sheen and got herself converted to Catholicism. It was not good optics, one would say, for psychoanalysis. Subsequently, Bishop Sheen published a counter book to Rabbi Liebman's Peace of Mind. It was called Peace of Soul, yeah? Which had even nastier and really potently anti-Semitic things to say about Freudianism. And this, then the debate exploded across the national media. So there's articles in every imaginable journal and newspaper about this, but sex is not the only issue. They do have a few theological discussions about free will, about guilt, and about the compatibility of science and religion. But the conversation kept circling back to sex and to this question of the theory of libido. So already close on the heels of Sheen's sermon at St. Patrick's, an author in the widely read monthly Catholic World said that despite, suddenly everybody's reading Freud, and suddenly they're all experts on what Freud supposedly stands for, said that despite Freud's various self-revisions, Freud had remained immovable in his conviction that individuals' problems were rooted in childhood and were always concerned with sexual excitations and reactions against them. Freud pushes all impulses back to sex energy, his well-known libido. Another person said, either Freudianism is wrong or the Christian tradition is absurd. So this idea that they're totally incompatible. And in the Christian Century, which is the flagship journal of U.S. Protestants, a Lutheran also worried about what he called Freud's overemphasis on sexual energy or libido. Now, the thing about the Menningers is that they themselves are faithful, believing Christians. They are Presbyterians. And no doubt, also, they're small-town Midwesterners. They live in Kansas rather than in, like, Los Angeles or New York, right? And so despite the fact that they have well-cultivated, close connections to individuals at the highest levels of the U.S. government and military, for example, William had been instrumental in persuading the Army to focus its psychiatric efforts on rehabilitation rather than diagnosis and discharge, and both of them were essential in getting more government funding for mental health services. The Menningers, because they're Kansas boys, basically, understand more acutely than many other practicing psychoanalysts just how fundamental, how real the worries of many Americans were whether they were Protestant or Catholic, about this nebulous, strange thing called psychoanalysis or Freud. Like, what is this weird system of thought? It wasn't like it was just a joke. It was really a scary, confusing, but kind of exciting and interesting thing for people, and they understood that intimately. And the Menninger's views mattered. As Time magazine in 1948, with William Menninger on the cover, I showed it to you before, explained, thanks to the Menningers, Topeka is the largest training center for psychiatrists in the world. And it trained 15% of all the psychiatrists now being trained in the United States. So I think it's worth pointing out this is also a matter of money, because it's not just a matter of religious beliefs, but also of business interests. So in the post-war years, because the Menningers are succeeding in getting so much government money flowing into mental health services, and psychoanalysis acquiring a surge of prestige within psychiatry because it turned out to be pretty useful for the military, for returning soldiers, the financial stakes were really high. So the analyst and historian Nathan Hale found that between 1948 and 1961, psychoanalytic institutes received over $1 million, that was a lot at the time, from the National Institute of Mental Health. And the Menninger Foundation alone received $885,000. Two of the largest recipients of National Institute of Mental Health funding were Yale and UCLA, again, were psychoanalyst-headed departments of psychiatry. So that's important to know in retrospect, but none of that was secure at the moment when the Catholic attacks came, right? In retrospect, we can see that, but at the time, they were nervous that they were not going to get this money. So the short version of what happened is that the Menninger brothers, first William, but then especially also Carl, developed an influential compromise formation.
Wie sagt man das auf Deutsch? Kompromissformel, ja?
Yeah?
So on the one hand, so they're stuck, right? On the one hand, they want to align themselves with the ego psychologists, the egos and not the neos. They don't like Karen Horney. They don't want to do that at all. So they want to endorse the most undiluted version of Freud's theory of libido. They want to say sex matters. So quote, William says, actually sex is, he says this in the New York Times magazine, sex is the basic and all-pervasive motivation in life, and it must be understood for a healthy mentality. Yeah, this is, sex is das Wichtigste im Leben überhaupt. This is 1948, William Menninger. At the same time, so this, in this way, they're positioning themselves against the Horney and against the neo-Freudians' rejection of libido and drive theory. But on the other hand, they're very anxious because the Catholics are accusing them of being too sex-focused. So what are they going to do? So they have to say, they need to claim that their aim is to reduce people's sex focusedness, and so their solution is to advance a conservative sexual morality and to argue that psychoanalysis is fully compatible with Christianity. But their hostility to Karen Horney put them in a bind. They wanted to say against Horney that we psychoanalysts are about sex, not just some search for safety in a scary world. But simultaneously against the Catholic attacks, they wanted to say we're not about sex. Or at least not about bad transgressive sex, we're about good, marital, loving sex. So Carl Menninger in particular made responding to the accusations into a crusade. So this is going on for several years now. This is 1951 and they're still having this argument. So there's a profile of Carl. It says, busy Dr. Menninger practices Presbyterianism as well as Freud. And he reports, the Time magazine reports that Menninger shares his own habit of prayer. He worked to counter the notion that psychoanalysts promoted a godless and moral philosophy, and he expressed annoyance, and he did this over and over in many venues, that, quote, many ministers and laymen apparently assume that the Freudians are in favor of general sexual promiscuity. But, Carl declares, this assumption is false, and its reiteration is a lie, a slander. Psychoanalysts do not favor promiscuity, do not encourage it, do not attempt to relieve any patient's guilt about it. Quite the reverse. Most psychoanalysts spend hours and hours attempting to relieve patients from the compulsive feeling of need for these very immoralities. Okay. So, finally, one year, it pays off, okay? So, in September of 52, the Pope, it's Pope Pius XII, weighs in. Why does the Pope have to weigh in? It's complicated. Karl Menninger's best friend, Leo Bartemeyer, is a Catholic, and he's been asked to be the head of the American Psychiatric Association, and he actually goes to the Pope to get his permission, and the Pope says, yeah, it's a good idea to have a Catholic in charge. And there's also been French and Canadian priests, in particular Catholic priests, who wanted to learn psychoanalysis because they thought that it actually might help them be better priests and take better care, do better pastoral counseling. So there's a lot of pressure from within the Catholic Church, also from the clergy, to make psychoanalysis be accepted by the Pope. So in 52, the Pope takes the occasion of a speech to an international gathering of medical professionals, and Pius gets straight to the heart of the arguments, and he distinguishes between one tendency within Freudianism, which he calls the pansexual, as of the Sexualmethode, the pansexual method, and that's absolutely unacceptable for any Catholic. And then there's alternative methods, he likes Jung a lot better, called Jung not so sex-focused, he says. Or it's also some Freudian ones that were less fixated on sex, which could be acceptable as long as the doctor and the patient steer clear of too much talk about sex. So the way it's usually understood is that Pius said it's okay to think about psychoanalysis as a therapeutic method, talking is okay, but he's sharply critical of what he thought was the centrality of sex in too much Freudian theory. So the method of talk is okay, but the theory about sex is not. Less than a year later, in April of 53, he finally officially relents even further. And what's really interesting is the Pope himself, you can read this online, he uses the language of the ego, the unconscious, the repressed, er hat das studiert. He understands the psychoanalytic terms. And he then says, science affirms that recent observations have brought to light the hidden layers of the psychic structure of man, and questions about the dynamisms, determinisms, and mechanisms hidden in the depth of the soul do belong to the areas of competence for therapists and psychologists alike. And he also said, you can go too far in talking about sexual matters, and he warned the therapist should never usurp the role of priest. But he allowed that some talk of sex could be beneficial, as long as it's done with calmness and objectivity. Okay, around the world, the news spread. So you get Paris and, you know, random newspapers all across the United States. Pius formally approved the use of psychoanalysis as a healing device, and Freud and Vatican sign armistice. It's like, it's just big international news. So clearly the pressure of popular interest and also clergy interest had forced the Pope to endorse the practice of psychoanalysis to some extent. So in one sense, Bishop Sheen had been defeated, not only because he himself, in his own way, with his talk shows and so on, had contributed to the psychologization of American Catholicism. Interestingly, subsequent Catholic interventions,
we have some examples here. Yeah, this is typical.
This is the early 50s. They're so happy now that the Pope has given them permission. And you can see sort of this mixture of the cross on the bottom and then the psychoanalytic psi to merge, right? They're talking about rapprochement, sources for a synthesis. So the point is that many Catholic commentators are eager for rapprochement, and they talk about, quote, peaceful coexistence of religion and psychiatry. And a number of Jesuit and other Catholic scholars basically find positive things to say also about Freud himself. So that in that way, it seems as though the bishop had been defeated. But from another perspective, Sheen had triumphed. Because as of the early 50s, psychoanalysts had become much more careful about revealing to a wider public any not utterly normative conservative ideas about sexuality. So even as early as 52, the French Jesuit Louis Bernier, looking over the United States and the situation, had said there's only a very limited school of pansexualism anywhere, perhaps none in the United States. And we don't know if that was him strategically saying there's no sex here, don't worry, so that the Pope could be encouraged to relax himself, or whether in fact it was already in fact an accurate summary. But it's pretty clear that both the neo-Freudians and the ego psychologists, in a way, had developed a kind of psychoanalysis in the post-war United States that was pretty much cleansed of any radical ideas about sex. Nonetheless, why did the American public care about psychoanalysis at all? Sex. It's the only reason. Like, it was the only thing that possibly would make them interested. It's a weird system of thought. They didn't understand it, but they were curious about it because they were curious about sex. And one of the problems with the post-neo-Freudian psychoanalysis that readers were increasingly treated to very sexist, very homophobic, very controlling, is that it would contribute even more to their misery within their marriages, right? It basically cause more trouble for their intimate relations rather than alleviating those. Nobody but Christian spokespeople had seriously challenged psychoanalysts' hegemony on expert discourse. Nobody until Alfred Kinsey burst onto the national scene in 1948 with the first volume. And initially in 48, it's the male volume, right? Sexual Behavior of the Human Male that comes out. Initially, some psychoanalysts, Carl Menninger included, were comfortable defending Kinsey's research, even if they made a few critical or qualifying remarks. Menninger, for instance, Carl Menninger, assured a female acquaintance in March of 48 that, quote, "I am sure it," the volume, "will be disquieting to many people who are not in intimate contact with the secret lives of individuals as psychiatrists are. But I can only tell you that every psychiatrist I know of is prepared to accept the Kinsey report as sound. Don't underestimate it. It's very, very important." That was 1948. That would change when the second volume of the Kinsey report on women appeared in 53. Still raw from the battle with the church, psychoanalysts were apoplectic. They were enraged at the way that the reports threw their statistics alone. They're very dry, boring books, right? They're just stats and stats and stats about people's orgasms. They're dull, it's safe to say. But the point is that Kinsey had basically created a frontal attack on the idea of constricting sex to monogamous heterosexual marriage. Among other things, Kinsey documented that there's not much difference between men and women in their capacity for orgasm, or for marital infidelity, or for sexual interest in general. And he actively advanced the view that homosexuality was a natural variant of human sexuality, and in fact a remarkably prevalent one. He found very high rates of same-sex contact. So suddenly, no longer skittish about being associated with sex, we're now in 53, right? Analysts were thrown on the defensive by the report's runaway popularity, suddenly rushed to announce their long-standing expertise on the topic of sex and to denigrate Kinsey's work, directly challenging his views on the normalcy of homosexuality and on the reality and strength of female sexual interest. So those are their two main objections. They can't believe that he's saying that women are just as sexual as men, and they can't believe that he's saying homosexuality is normal. But the way they do that is they sort of make a sideways argument. They say that Kinsey treats humans zoologically, like they're animals, not like they're humans. And above all, they say that Kinsey is an ignoramus about love. They hadn't much cared about love before this moment. Suddenly, it's incredibly convenient. So in this book, it's one of the big collections of psychoanalytic critiques of Kinsey. Saul Ginsberg, New York analyst, complains about Kinsey's apparent, quote, "need to separate sex from love," right? You know that all he did was he counted up, there's like tabellen, like tables of sex from masturbation, sex, same-sex contact, premarital, extramarital, marital, you know, cross-gender, like every kind of possible way you could have orgasms. So they're all interchangeable. There's just lots of numbers that people have. So they say he separates sex from love. He separates sex from tenderness, from concern with the feelings and needs of one's partner. This is the quote. "Such a separation of the genital from other aspects of one's sexual attitudes itself represents an abnormality in individuals." So they're starting to make an argument that it is in itself pathological to separate sex from love. Okay? Iago Goldston, another analyst in New York, attacked Kinsey for praising primitive peoples like the Lepcha, that's in Nepal, quote, "among whom sexual activity is practically divorced from emotion. Like food and drink, it doesn't matter from whom you receive it as long as you get it. In Kinsey's scheme of things, there seems to be little room for love, to say nothing of ideals as may override our mammalian heritage, our mammal, our animal heritage." And not to be left out, Carl Menninger announced, quote, "as for an orgasm being the chief criterion of sexuality, everyone knows that one orgasm can differ from another as widely as do kisses." He's right, of course, right? But then the examples that he gave were telling. Quote, "the orgasm of a terrified soldier in battle, that of a loving husband in the arms of his wife, that of a desperate homosexual trying to prove his masculinity, and that of a violent and sadistic brute raping a child are not the same phenomena." Menninger also approvingly cited another author who argued that, quote, Unless the movement towards sexual integration is an expression of love for the other person, there can be no normal sexual ecstasy. Sorry, I can never read the sentence without laughing. Sexual promiscuity, sorry, or experimentation or athleticizing without feelings of tenderness and affection is destructive. Okay. Menninger confronted Kinsey directly in public.
Quote, they disagreed about women. So the argument is,
do women want love or do women want orgasms? Okay. There is much more that could be said about what I've come to call the love doctrine, the Liebesdoktrin, and the damage it eventually did in countless lives. And I would point out, in this audience, you all know this, right, it's very far off track from Sigmund Freud's own view that many, many people have trouble bringing lust and love together. Right, Freud had remarked on the frequent disconnect between love and sexual desire. In German, it's wo sie lieben, begehren sie nicht, wo sie begehren, können sie nicht lieben. Where they love, they cannot desire, and where they desire, they cannot love. So this claim in the early 1950s United States that loveless sex is in and of itself pathological, it's a novel post-war development. It's a brand new idea. Point number two, it's not innocent. I mean, it's not like, I think some French historian once said to me, but don't you know? Sex with love is better for women. The point is that historically, there was nothing banal about this disavowal of the extraordinary prevalence of loveless sex also within heterosexual marriages. Why are all these women on the couch in the United States? Like, you think they're going there because they're happy in their marriages? No. This is totally tone deaf, and nobody knew better than psychoanalysts how unhappy many women were. So but there was so much experience of women's alienation within heterosexual marital sex. It's an issue that would explode into the public at the latest with the rise of the women's movement that I showed you the pictures of at the beginning, right? There's a reason there's a feminist movement in the United States. There's a reason that there's a feminist backlash against post-war American psychoanalysis. Third, however, the paradigm would be enormously influential. Psychoanalysis ascended in the first two decades of the Cold War precisely by offering a secular moral sensibility that reinforced conservative family values under the sign of health. One that was expressly contemptuous of homosexuality and of any expression of female sexuality outside of marriage. Some people fit the norms effortlessly, but the wastage of lives, the traumas of homosexuals subjected to disrespect and conversion attempts, and the miseries within numberless heterosexual marriages were immense. Not until the sexual revolution of the 60s, first the pill, then the deluge of porn, the explosion of public chatter about free love, and the incitement to loosen mores and to defend rights, not until then would all this come undone. And with that revolution, psychoanalysis in the US was forced to retreat into a niche existence from which it never really emerged or recovered. So yes, there were rescue attempts. Among them, in the 1970s, a turn to the study of narcissistic and borderline character disorders, think Heinz Kohut and Otto Kernberg, that was one rescue effort. Also in the 1970s, a growing concern, finally, after a long delay, with the experiences of Holocaust survivors, as well as second generation experiences of their children. Ultimately, the rise of feminist, and now in recent years, also queer-friendly, and generally more democratic, less authoritarian versions of psychoanalysis. And in the 1980s, based on a big lawsuit, finally as well, the entry of psychologists, psychologen, right, not just psychiatrists, into the American Psychoanalytic Association. And with them, a stronger focus on two-person relational forms of psychoanalysis. But I can tell you that Freudianism in the US never really managed to shake its ugly reputation for being just bizarrely lurid, misogynist, and homophobic, just plain stupid and wrong, superseded by shorter-term cognitive behavioral approaches, psychopharmacology, and neuroscience. Let's talk sex. But the conclusion here now is this. Freudian psychoanalysis in the US initially and pretty successfully reconfigured itself in response to widely publicized criticisms from Christian church leaders. They were completely unprepared to be outflanked by new competition, but they pulled that off as well for a good long run of 20 years, because it was in their testy antagonism to Kinsey that they solidified yet further the sexist and homophobic views for which they've become so justly notorious. But the shape their arguments took had been co-determined by the prior arguments with Bishop Fulton Sheen
And before that, with the now so often forgotten Karen Horney. Thank you.